The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to our Tuesday program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. And our guest, who I will introduce in just a minute, Bob Zimmerman, is ready to get going. A couple of quick announcements first. The phone number for those of you who would like to call and talk with Bob is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Let the phone ring. We'll get you up on air as quickly as possible. We do answer the phone during the break. So don't let an upcoming break stop you from making that phone call. Email, if you'd rather send us an email, is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And then you can also send us a comment through our blog, which is on our website. And to do that, it is thespaceshow.com, all the way to the far right for the upcoming show menu bar. Pick the first show. That is the Bob Zimmerman Show. And then open it up. That is our blog and archive page. And all the way down at the bottom is where you can post your comment. And as soon as I get a copy of it, I will be able to integrate it into the show tonight. So those are the three ways that you can get a hold of us: email, blog, and toll-free phone line. And the toll-free phone line is our preferred way. So let me give it out to you again. 1-866-687-7223. Also on our website, upper left menu, there's a couple of items to call to your attention. Under support, there is the store for buying Space Show logo wear, so please visit it. Suggestions are always welcome. Hope you find some items of interest. There also is a listen live button in that upper left menu. So remember, listen live tells you how to listen to live broadcast, and it tells you how to listen to archive broadcasts that are compressed MP3s on the website on podcast and using Alexa. And we have the TuneIn player embedded on the site for those of you using Alexa. I think you can also listen to the live show on Alexa. Somebody might want to correct me on that if I am wrong. If you have any questions about any of that, don't hesitate to email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. There is a website newsletter over on the right side of the homepage, and that is updated fresh every Sunday after the Sunday Space Show program ends. So do check it out. Be sure you scroll down, and you can see who's coming on board. And we're, I think we're booked up through August now, and we're doing September, which is the last month of the third quarter of this year. Boy, time does fly. Your guest suggestions are always welcome. So when you send them to me, tell me who it is, why you think they should be on the show, and if you have their electronic contact information, that would be a terrific help. Remember also, we are a nonprofit 501c3, and we are supported by your contributions. If you like our programs, if you like our guests, if you like participating in our show, please help us stay on the air and support us. And your support is really important. So as a 501c3 nonprofit with our parent, OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, you get a tax break on your gift if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer. The same is true if you're a California taxpayer. For more information, visit the nonprofit's website, again, OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Or email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then also note that we do have sponsors, and you see the sponsor ads running across the homepage. The sponsor can change that ad whenever the sponsor would like. And on full-length shows, which tonight is, I read short messages from the sponsors. So for segment number one tonight, Northrop Grumman is our sponsor. They're a leading global security company, and they provide innovative systems, products, and solutions for government and commercial customers worldwide. And their capabilities go from the bottom of the ocean to outer space and cyberspace. The Space Foundation is a sponsor. They have their annual space report available now. You can find it on their homepage, spacefoundation.org. It's sort of a standard and Bible to let you know how the commercial space and public sector are doing. It does include new space companies as well. The National Space Society is a sponsor, NSS.org. And remember, they do support and sponsor many things that we also believe in, like space settlement, for example. So do check them out. And then the Space Development Network is a sponsor, and they're an online group that has you and other space advocates like you joining together to advance the plan for space development. And they're looking for people with a wide variety of interest and skills. It's a free network to join. Do check it out, their website, spacedevelopment.org. A couple of quick announcements for you. There may not be a Hotel Mars tomorrow where John Batchelor wants to do a Hayabusa 2 show, and the people that we have been contacting are on airplanes tomorrow for some reason. There must be some big central clearinghouse event going for all the people we're contacting. So we're not sure yet, so follow the website if you're interested in Hotel Mars tomorrow. Then, in addition, Tori Bruno of ULA is coming back on the show next week. And if you're interested in talking with Mr. Bruno, the show will be 1 hour in length. But if you send me your advanced emails and with questions that you want to ask him about ULA or anything related, I will start collecting them and will make sure your question is asked, as long as it's civil. So I believe Tori is on Monday, but you can check the upcoming show menu just to be sure about that. And again, your advanced emails are welcome. Last time he was on, he crashed the server, so many of you who wanted to listen live were unable to do so. But again, if you send me your emails, I will be sure to make sure he hears your email question. I'll read it on air for you. So please pay attention to that. And then one other announcement that I'm making for all this week. We have played the game like nice little boys, and we have converted all of our websites to Chrome SSL. And it has caused some problems, as to be expected, which we are resolving. So if you are visiting the spaceshow.com's website or onegiantleapfoundation.org's website, so if you're using Chrome and it says it's unsecure over on the left, it is secure. We're working with our hosting company to fix the glitches. But if you see something that's not working on our websites, please call it to my attention so that we can get it resolved. You're my best eyes and ears out there for troubleshooting after making these changes for Chrome and Google, and we appreciate your support and help in doing that. And Bob Zimmerman is our guest again today, and it's nice to have him back with us. We haven't talked to him for a couple of weeks. Bob is an extremely well-known, highly respected historian, author, space policy news person. He has an outstanding website, which you should be referring to several times a day, not just for space news, but for science in general, cultural things. His cultural breaks of music and entertainment are really, really fun. And there's just a whole bunch of reasons to be visiting Behind the Black. We've talked about his books before, The Universe in a Mirror, The Saga of the Hubble Space Telescope. We've also talked about Leaving Earth. That's the first time I met Bob. I put him on the show for Leaving Earth, Space Stations, Rival Superpowers, and the Quest for Interplanetary Travel. His book about Genesis 8, the Apollo 8, Genesis, the story of Apollo 8. Bob, this may be one of those nights for me. Anyway, read his full bio. It is on the Space Show website, but Bob has really a lot of credentials, and he's the most interesting guy. And Behind the Black should be visited, as I said, multiple times a day, because he does put stuff up on a very timely basis. Welcome back to the show, Bob. How are you?
Oh, I'm so glad to be here, David. Yeah, you know, Genesis, Story of Apollo 8, it's the 30th anniversary this year of the publication of the book. It's also the 50th. This coming December will be the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 8 mission to the moon. So it's a big deal. We're going to have an audiobook out very, 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 very shortly of Genesis, which I've heard it myself. It's just incredibly well read. And so
and,
I'm looking forward to that.
And look at all the places we've gone in space since we went to the moon.
Yeah, well, you know, excuse me, I have a cold, so I will try not to cough too much or sneeze, but... Yeah, we haven't really gone any place for the last 30 years, you know, 50 years.
50 years.
It's very sad.
50 years.
Yeah, it's very sad. And basically what we've been doing is as our space program has become a government jobs program for the last 50 years, limited to essentially launching government ships into orbit to go around the Earth to justify jobs here on Earth without actually accomplishing anything of any significance. That's generally what has happened in the United States and in Russia for the last 50 years, and it's pretty tragic. China is now getting its space program really up to speed. It's hard to say in the long run where they're going to end up. They probably will end up the same way because they're a government program. And even though right now they're trying to use it to establish their bona fides as a world power, and therefore they want to do well in space, it's still a government program. And therefore, that's really the result of any government program in the end is dry rot and waste and big budgets and lots of pork and not much accomplished. That's generally where it goes. So that's where we've been for the last half century. And, you know, when I first came on your show, maybe the first time that David, no, I wouldn't say that, but I would say about a decade ago when I said that we were in a transition from government space to private space, and that transition is beginning to finally bear fruit. And and that might finally get us out of this non-productive period, and maybe have something really start happening.
You have an email question already from.
Oh boy, we do. I haven't even gotten to the topics we were going to talk about. You know.
Well,
but that's okay.
Linda's in Olympia, Washington, and she says, "Everybody, including you, say we haven't done anything for 50 years or so." So let's turn the clock back, and we have just completed the last Apollo mission. Maybe let's say we've completed Skylab. We can include that, too. What was the state of our life support and technology back then, and what could we have done to go further out into space, to go to Mars, to do all the things that everybody dreamed about? How quickly could we have done it if we had actually had a will to do it, in your opinion?
Well, okay, you must remember that the Saturn V rocket, as designed by Wernher von Braun, was designed to be an interplanetary spaceship. Skylab was specifically testing that capability, and it very successfully testing that capability, without any question at all. There were, of course, a lot of things that needed to be learned in Earth orbit to make such a journey safe. Wernher von Braun himself recognized that in 56. He said it was going to be a century before we got to Mars. In 56, he said that, 1956. So he knew that even if he had a space station built around the Saturn V in Earth orbit, it was going to take decades of research there to get us anywhere. So from a technological point of view, we had the building blocks, and we could have started. Well, absolutely. But in terms of the actual legal and political and cultural structure necessary to make it happen, we didn't have it in place. And in fact, our government destroyed it in the early 60s. And this is something I've talked about on your show at least once before, David. I've written about it. I've given papers on this. The establishment of the government, quasi-government corporation called COMSAT, destroyed the American satellite industry starting in the mid 60s for at least two decades, because it, by government fiat, ordered that all satellites in orbit must be built by COMSAT, which was half owned and controlled by the federal government. and by politics, essentially. And so that squelched independent commercial development of space from the ground. And the demonstration of that is that prior to the passing of ComSat's law, AT&T had financed and built and paid for the launch of several satellites called Telstar, and they were planning to launch a constellation of Telstar satellites to replace their ocean cables, because it was very expensive to do ocean cables. They didn't have the capacity, and they easily broke, and they were very expensive, while satellites were much cheaper and had higher capacity and could be replaced easier. And they were planning to do this, and John Kennedy and the Congress stepped in and basically said, no, you can't, and stopped it. And so that was the first step in squelching.
Yeah, but they selected the Hughes Syncon and started in with Geocom.
Yeah,
so.
But you see, I'll give you an example of what happened. Like by the end of the 60s, the American cable networks and television networks wanted to launch their own television satellites to provide broadcast from across the globe. And they couldn't. They were not allowed to.
Yeah, they couldn't do it. It was regulated.
Broadcasting was not developed in the United States. It was developed by Japan because we couldn't do it. We were not allowed.
Yeah, it was totally regulated.
Well, commercial operation significantly. And think about this. Had AT&T built that constellation in the 60s, think about the business for the launch industry. You would have suddenly had customers for the launch industry in America that would have brought business to them, and we have had a young launch industry then. And that's the first cultural problem.
Well, I would also take some issue with you, because their ground stations were outrageously costly, and that there's no assurance that their Telstar system would have economically survived.
Well, I've run these numbers and analyzed it, and they themselves did the same thing. The cost for putting in a ocean cable was somewhere in the range, in those days, of about $70 million. $70 million. It would give them maybe 30 voice channels across the cable. That's 30 phone calls. They could put up Telstar. The first Telstar had about 300 voice cables, and it cost them $3 million to launch it and about $3 million to build it. That's $6 million.
And the irony is, in the late 1990s and the early 2000s, all the satellite programs went under when the undersea fiber optics cables came in a big way and changed everything for economics.
That's true. There were other
issues. But that was 40 years later.
In the 90s. But to answer Linda's question, now I've given you at least one area where legally we prevented private enterprise from functioning.
Absolutely. Everything was totally regulated.
Right.
Absolutely.
And the second place we really crushed American independency and commercial operations in the 70s when the shuttle arrived was we outlawed private launch industry. All payloads
on the shuttle
have to go on the shuttle.
Absolutely, and that gave Ariane their commercial lead.
That's right. Yeah. And it wiped out McDonnell Douglas, and I can name a bunch of other American companies that had launch services and were making money and had a potential for at least making commercial operations.
Dumb move.
Yes. So to answer Linda's question, what we could have done differently, we had the technology to have done something.
We could have started, is what you're saying. We could have been well on our way.
That's right. And all we needed to do was have faith in the concepts that built the country, which has to do with freedom and private enterprise and allowing the citizens to choose what they wish to do. And instead, this was the 20th century, which was strongly influenced in all nations, even during the Cold War in the United States, by concepts of collectivism and centralized control. And the idea of using the government to accomplish things, even in the United States during the Cold War, was very dominant. And so there's no doubt that we decided as a nation in the 60s and 70s to model our space effort after a Soviet-style top-down system. And we squelched it. And the result is that 50 years later, we hadn't accomplished much. And it's only in the last decade and a half that we have finally started to free ourselves completely from that model, and there's private efforts to do things independent of the federal government and really compete in the marketplace. And that you have to give Elon Musk and SpaceX most of the credit for that. And because of that, we have new innovation, we have lowering of costs, and suddenly there's a renaissance building. So that's how I would answer Linda's question. The bottom line is, yes, we didn't have the same sophisticated technology that we might have today, but we had the technology that got us to the moon. We could do it. We just simply had to have the will and the faith in our own country's roots to make it happen properly.
Yeah, we could have been well on our way for sure.
We would have probably had
some kind of a lunar settlement going on a perpetual basis, I would imagine.
Well, we would still have been faced in the 70s with the same problem we face today, which is the Outer Space Treaty, which would have outlawed us from claiming any territory, which means our laws don't apply to any colony we have. Property rights, therefore, are not allowed. This is a problem that still exists, and I don't see an immediate answer to it because there's no will to change that treaty or get out of it. But even so, had we moved forward with American concepts of freedom and private enterprise, there would have been competition, there would have been profits made, and we would have dominated the field because Americans, when they compete, are very dominant here. We have the culture that allows that. And as SpaceX is demonstrating, as several companies are now demonstrating, Blue Origin as well, if you allow freedom to function, our culture thrives on that. Everybody else doesn't allow it to function, so then they have trouble competing. And so what we did instead, we tried to copy everybody else, which is not as successful. Well, the United States was successful because it decided not to follow the old ideas of the old world, but trying new things, which has to do with freedom and private enterprise.
Turning to more
mundane.
Not current issues.
Yes.
Rather than Linda's 50-year-old question, although it's going to be interesting to see how they spin the celebration for 50 years, because these issues are going to come up. And all kinds of perspectives and views are going to be represented. So it's going to be interesting to see how all of that is treated next year.
I'm going to have my say, David. There's no question of that.
Are you participating in any event?
Not that I know of at this moment in time, but because, 50th anniversary of Apollo 8, I'm sure that I'm going to be in a few events along the way. At least one I've already been scheduled in December to give a lecture. So, I'm here. I've written this book, and therefore, I will be asked for opinions. I will tell you right now that... The issue that Linda raised about what stopped us in the 50s and 60s is essentially what has been stopping us even now. And to a certain extent, within the United States, there is a Cold War going on, no longer with a communist nation outside the U.S., but a communist, socialist, top-down, governmental body within the United States fighting that commercial free enterprise concept. And that battle has been ongoing now for a decade. They are fighting the I would call them the bad guys in the government, have been fighting a nonstop defensive battle to slow commercial space down as much as they can. You know, we can describe, there are three main well-known big projects at NASA that everyone pays attention to. They are SLS Orion, that's manned space. There is the Commercial Crew Operations to ISS, that's manned space. And then there's the James Webb Space Telescope. And all three of those programs have experienced significant delays. Ungodly delays, especially SLS Orion and James Webb. And they have different reasons for the delays, but the reason the commercial crew has been slowed down in the last 4 years is almost exclusive because there are factions within NASA and within the big contracting world that is linked to NASA, such as Boeing and Lockheed Martin, that are acting to encourage a slowdown of commercial space so that SLS Orion don't look so bad and Boeing doesn't look so bad. They didn't want SpaceX to launch its Dragon capsule years ahead of Boeing. They wanted it to be almost the same time, if not Boeing first. And so they've delayed SpaceX really hard. And those delays, almost every single one of them, is not justifiable. They're mostly having to do with safety questions. You can argue, yes, maybe this, maybe that. But overall, they all strike me as fake, as fraud, and as designed by a bureaucracy to slow SpaceX and Boeing down. And that's really disgraceful, and that's why Commercial Crew is 4 years late and might not even launch next year or the year after. And it's not because they're not ready. SpaceX has delivered its first capsule to Florida, and they demonstrated with both Zuma and X-37B launches that they can say yes to a launch, get a payload, and launch extremely fast if necessary. So that capsule's at Kennedy. I guarantee you, their schedule says they can launch. They want to launch by the end of August. NASA's not saying that's off, but it's been made clear in quiet whispers that that's not going to happen. If NASA would get out of the way, SpaceX could launch that capsule within a month. There's no doubt in my mind about that. But they're not going to because of safety certification issues that NASA's demanding that have nothing to do with engineering, really, but have everything to do with paperwork.
You've got a call waiting already.
Okay, let's talk.
Hold on. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Marshall. How are you doing, Bob?
I'm doing just fine, Marshall. Why am I not surprised it's you?
As I recall, the COTS program is really the divide between independent design and building of space vehicles and the bureaucratic design and building of space vehicles. Who actually was the key person that started COTS, and how does it keep going if the bureaucrats don't like it?
Well, COTS is dead. COTS hasn't existed for a few years. The commercial crew contracts that exist have not been built under the COTS program concepts. The Congress and NASA working together forced Boeing and SpaceX to accept many of the contractual bureaucracy that NASA likes instead of the simplicity of COTS. The one thing that they were able to keep and NASA kept, because NASA thought it was a good idea actually, was the fixed price contract. So that's one aspect that's maybe the most important that has stayed. But COTS itself and its simplicity is gone. There were many people involved in the initial establishment of COTS. The history of that goes back to the Bush administration. There were people in the Bush administration that first proposed the idea. I can't, off the top of my head, I cannot remember.
Well, Mike Griffin is the one that put it through and got it.
Well, Mike Griffin was not the heart of that. He was for it, but it came from below him, and some people actually in OMB in the Bush administration itself were pushing the idea, and there was turf warfare in NASA that opposed it for all the reasons that I just have described. There was a complete lack of faith in private enterprise to do something like this. I will tell you that you will know this, David, because we've been through this for decades, but if you suggested that private companies could do this and build both capsules for manned and unmanned cargo and do it without NASA's participation, people thought you were nuts back 10 years ago. And there was a lot of resistance and fear.
No, I remember Mike fought for it in NASA, but it barely got approved and became the policy. It almost didn't make it.
It almost didn't make it. What really came down to was the... when Obama won the presidency in 2008, they had not yet launched the cargo missions. They thought they would have launched them by that point. And they made, I think, a decision within the Bush administration that we have got to award the commercial crew contracts before the end of this administration or they will never happen. And so literally the last week of the Bush administration, the SpaceX and SpaceX, this is not commercial crew, this would be cargo, I'm sorry. They had development contracts, but they had not gone as far as necessary. The last week of the Bush administration, they awarded those cargo contracts. And they were basically a fait accompli. And so the Obama administration accepted. And in fact, Lori Garver and the Obama administration was actually very supportive, and Charles Bolden supported the commercial contracts very much so, because for the same reasons that I've outlined, they saved money, they were faster way to do things, and they got things accomplished. And in fact, the Obama administration, if they had just played politics a little bit better, they might have made it go faster. But instead, they tried to cancel Constellation in a very clumsy way. way, and that only made Congress angry and made them impose SLS on NASA instead.
You're going exactly where I kind of want to lead you in. That is, how much is it the problem caused by Congress versus bureaucrats?
It starts always with Congress. Always.
Yeah.
But that's the nature of our country. Congress passes the law, but Congress passes the budget. The bureaucracy at NASA and the politics within NASA as well as the administration influences Congress significantly. And so there's a push-pull between the two, without doubt. And so you have a push-pull. The Bush administration, followed by the Obama administration, wanted commercial space, and they pushed Congress. Congress didn't want it, pushed back. They pushed back together. They eventually made a compromise that slowed down commercial space in its first 4 years, but it nonetheless didn't kill it. And then eventually commercial space showed success, and so it's harder for Congress to say no. Congress is, I'd say, a bigger problem, to be honest. Congress in general is a big problem. The whole federal government is a big problem. It is dysfunctional right now, the federal government. There isn't anything that the federal government does on its own that they do well. Nothing.
Yeah.
And that's partly the blame of Congress. It's partly the blame of the executive branch, the people that work there. It is why we got Donald Trump. I mean, this is not an endorsement of Donald Trump, I'm not an insane, wild-eyed hater of him. I look at him very honestly, and I see that his existence exists because of the complete dysfunctional nature of the federal government and the unwillingness of Congress and elected officials and the bureaucracy to do anything about it, to fix it.
I totally agree. The key thing is, how in the hell do you get them to do the right thing? And that is 80% of the problem with NASA.
Well, yeah, and that's a problem for another show, because I don't want to go down the political road.
I'm talking about NASA.
Okay.
And talking about getting politicians to do the right thing. There's something we have which is called elections.
Yeah, well.
And that applies to NASA as well. We have to be willing to. I'll give you an example. Bill Nelson's up for a re-election as a senator. He's been a big proponent of SLS now for decades. He thinks SLS is God's gift to the space program. Without it, we will accomplish nothing. Well, he should go, because he doesn't understand. He's out of date. He has no concept of what's working and what isn't, and he's hurting our space effort by focusing on a big government-run project that's just mainly boondoggle and pork, rather than trying to get private enterprise to accomplish something. So he's up for a re-election. He's not doing well, and he shouldn't. He should go.
Who's he
and
running?
And that applies to others as well.
Is space an issue in Florida for him?
Mm-hmm.
Because usually
space
is not an issue for anyone.
No, it's always an issue in Florida because it's a major employer. I mean, whether, you know, that's an interesting question. It's a major employer, so you think, oh, the pork there is going to give him votes. But there is clear indications that the American public nationwide, in even constituent districts that get lots of money, is sick of the fact that nothing is getting accomplished. And I'm talking space here now. I mean, I'll give you an example. I wrote about this on my website, Behind the Black. If you do a search on Behind the Black for the word winning and commercial space, you'll get to this article I wrote. I went to a conference in L.A. I had a choice between going to a new space conference or going to an AIAA conference to give a lecture. And I went to the AIAA conference. It's basically that's an engineering organization for the commercial, for the big space industry. It's a trade organization, and they wanted me to give a lecture. And I went there, and I talked to a lot of people, and they actually had a presentation, and I was astonished to find out that people who are members of AIAA, which includes mostly people from the big contractors like Boeing and Lockheed Martin, they were sick of SLS and Orion. They wanted private commercial space. I was shocked to find that out. And I talked to a lot of them. They said, we're not getting anything done. We're engineers. We want to build things. And what we've got instead is a pork project. And so, yes, it gives us money, but we really don't want to do that. We want to build things. And so I think that the key here is the vote, and people have to finally kick the bums out. We have a lot of bums in Congress, both parties, who have done nothing for us for decades. And I'm talking space here, but, you know, there is a reason we have Trump.
Yeah. I better get off the line before David hangs me.
Yeah, you're right about that.
Thank you, Marshall. It's always a pleasure.
You know, I'm a member of AIAA, so
yeah.
And I go to their conferences all the time, except since they've been moving them to Florida. I haven't gone down to Florida for it. But one of the issues that Nelson's got is the Florida space economy is recovering from the shutdown of the shuttle era and all that went on down there, but it's recovering with new space and commercial space companies. Blue, SpaceX, all sorts of other entrepreneurial companies are there. If you go up and down the space coast, you'll see them taking over vacant buildings and the small sat groups and stuff like that. So the big traditional aerospace industry that Nelson has represented for what, three terms or some four terms or more than that, is being what's diluted with new space and emerging commercial space.
He
needs
to
pay attention to that.
It's a problem for him because he doesn't recognize he thinks SLS is the big deal that everyone wants, but the truth is people who live in Florida have seen very clearly now that, no, that's not them.
And they've been burned by it when shuttle went down, and they lost jobs and houses and all sorts of stuff, and it's coming back as a result of new space and commercial space.
It's coming, and you know, the thing that's important to recognize is it's coming back in a much more robust manner, and the people who live in a place like Florida are going to see right away they are much more secure having a robust, competitive space industry than having one giant government program like the shuttle or SLS, because they're now told with a single giant government program, they're completely dependent on Congress on that one project. If it gets killed like the shuttle, everything goes down. But if you've got a robust, competitive free market of many different companies making money, if one goes down, others come up, and you've got a very robust economy. And that's what Florida is experiencing now. And I think that's one of the reasons. It's not the only one, but it's one of the reasons that Nelson is actually in trouble, because I think the Space Coast is beginning to recognize that his old-style boondoggle pork is really not a good solution. And as voters, we have to start to do that kind of stuff. You know, they always talk about how everybody hates Congress but loves their own congressman. And the reason is because in the past, it's always been argued they like the constituent services and the money that the
Congress bring home the pork for the local districts, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think the public no longer buys that anymore. It's once again, I use Trump as an example. We have him because the public is sick of this. It's not accomplishing things, and the federal government routinely is dysfunctional. They cannot get anything accomplished. And, you know, I talk about space. I mentioned Webb. I mentioned SLS. Now, though I mentioned the reason why commercial space is delayed. It's not being delayed, commercial space, because of the commercial companies. They can launch. It's being delayed by the bureaucracy. Well, now let's talk about SLS Orion and James Webb. Those operations are delayed not because of bureaucracy or stupid rules. They are delayed by outright incompetence. I mean, I could go down. I've documented some behind the black whenever it happens. The tubing in the fuel lines of the SLS rocket was contaminated. They had to clean it all out. The subcontractor didn't do a proper cleaning job. They built a mobile launcher. It leans. They think it's okay, but it leans. And in fact, it's also not sufficient for future launches, so they got to build a second mobile launcher.
Mobile launcher.
The cost of the two mobile launches is going to cost more than it took SpaceX. It's going to cost more to build two mobile launchers than it took SpaceX to develop the Falcon Heavy. They built a test stand in a way that it's like the analogy I can give is imagine you're building a bridge and you start on both ends, and when you come in the middle what happened with the test stand. Rebuilt it. They had weak welds in the SLA tanks. They dropped an oxygen tank dome and damaged it. Plus, there was a GAO report that pointed out that the management at SLS is absolutely insane. Every division operates independently within that thing, so there is no central management. And then I could talk about Orion. You know, we're going to spend $15 billion in more than a dozen years to build three capsules. Three capsules, $15 billion. It's ridiculous. Major cost overruns, that's Lockheed Martin. We're not even just building the capsule. The service module is being built by Europe. And they're 2 years to build one, and they don't have enough time. There was cracks in the welding of the Orion capsule. And then, of course, they did their great, you might remember back in 2014, they were trying to sell SLS, so they did a, quote, test flight of Orion using a Delta Heavy rocket.
Yeah, I remember that.
And they made a big deal how they're testing the heat shield. It was a lie. It was a lie. I don't mince words. When you lie, you lie. They knew before that launch happened that they had already decided to abandon the heat shield they were testing. It was too expensive and too slow to build using old Apollo technologies. They were going to go with something different. But they did that test flight anyway and sold it to the public and to the press as, well, we're testing our heat shield. It was a fake test. And it was total public relations garbage. And this is Orion and SLS. You think LOPG in lunar orbit is going to be any better? I doubt that. And it's, once again, it doesn't give us the capability of landing, so we'll be trapped in orbit while we watch others colonize the moon. Then you talk about Webb. Webb was supposed to cost $1 billion. It was supposed to be finished by 2011. It's now going to cost almost $10 billion, and it's not going to launch probably till 2020 at the earliest. Well, that's more than a decade behind schedule, 20 years in the construction. And on top of that, the deal with the European Space Agency, their partnership deal, their barter agreement to have time on the telescope, is they provide the launch service.
At Ariane, yeah.
Ariane 5. Well, by 2020, Ariane 5 is about to be retired. If we don't launch soon, the rocket won't be available. And that's a problem. Because they're designing everything around that, you know, it's link the two together. They're going to have a problem. It's incompetence. It's dysfunctional. This is not how you build something. I don't care how complicated James Webb might be. It is unconscionable how long and how much money it's taking. And, you know, the most recent delays were because of very bad, incompetent work, Northrop Grumman. And I'm going to mute for a second. I have to call up. Sorry about that. And now we could go on to the W first, which is supposedly going to be the next generation space telescope after James Webb.
The Wide Field Telescope.
Wide Field Infrared Space Telescope. First of all, I want to just emphasize, I've said this many times in your show, but I'm going to say it again. I've done this on Behind the Black, too. James Webb is not a replacement the Hubble. It is not a next-generation Hubble. It is a completely different kind
completely
of telescope.
Different.
It's infrared versus optical.
Right.
So we have to mention that because NASA, for not recently, thank God, they finally realized that people were calling on them. But NASA, for many years, tried to sell it as the replacement for Hubble, and it's not. They're going to sell W first as a replacement for Webb, and in a sense it is, in a sense it isn't. It's going to be doing different kind of research. But W first has a history that to me is very fishy, because when the astronomy community, every decade, the astronomy community does what they call a
decadal survey.
And that decadal survey surveys the community and tries to get that community's preferences for what they should do in the next decade, what they should ask NASA to do in the next decade. And they've done this since the 60s, and it's been a very good system. In fact, a lot of the science groups have copied the astronomy community in this, but the astronomy community has been the most successful at it. And this is where Webb came from. The decadal survey in around 2001 called for Webb. Well, the decadal survey that was released in 2011, when it was being prepared, scientists, astronomers nationwide were writing what they called white papers, proposing their concepts for what the decadal survey should do. There must have been more than 100 of these white papers. I read them all. I was writing articles for Astronomy and Sky Telescope at the time about this. And not one of those white papers proposed W first. Not one. There were some proposals similar to W first, but not the same thing. In fact, reading all those papers, that was not the first choice of the astronomy community by any means, a wide field infrared telescope. In fact, talking to a lot of astronomers, the first choice in 2010 or so they would have had was putting up telescopes that could get a better look at exoplanets. And a wide field infrared telescope is not what you'd use for that. So when the decadal survey came out in 2001, out of the blue, out of nowhere, suddenly they proposed W first. It was not proposed by the astronomy community. It was proposed by the people who were in charge of writing and issuing the decadal survey. In other words, they took advantage of their position to propose their pet project. And the astronomy community, the politics involved, once again, with government today, basically was forced to go along with it. And NASA's accepted it, and this is a project that they say is going to cost is going to cost $3.5 billion. Well, they're just in the design stages, and they're already over budget and behind schedule. And so, what really WFIRST is, in my mind, is not a space telescope. It is a variation on James Webb. It is a Jobs pork program. It's going to take at least a decade to build, and it'll be pouring $1 billion plus into pork for the next decade, year by year. And that's what Webb has done, and they need to replace that pork with another project when Webb finally, hopefully, launches. And that's what Webb, WFIRST, really is. And it gets back to the federal government. It is dysfunctional. It is not serving the nation by doing what it's supposed to do. The very fact that people in NASA and government are proposing the Lunar Orbital Platform Gateway, LOPG, is disgraceful, because it's clearly not a smart choice of what to do. It's not even a good choice of what to do with the space launch system. You know, the Space Launch System can put a lot of tonnage up into orbit, so you have a lot of flexibility in what you can do. Cubby-holding it into putting up a intermittently occupied small space station orbiting the moon is insane. It's not doing what you could do with SLS in the most effective manner. But that's what they're proposing, and they're not proposing it because they want to explore space. They're proposing it to try to justify the contracts and the jobs within the big contract.
Well,
I've made you speechless, David.
What are they proposing that meets with your approval?
Well, you know, once again, there are factions within NASA and within the federal government and within the Trump administration that have multiple positions. And the encouragement of private space, obviously, is the one thing that matters. That's what that counts. And that's been happening, and it continues to happen with greater strength because it works. And it makes the argument against it harder and harder to make over the decades. For example, the first 4 years of commercial space, Congress didn't want to fund it, and there was a fight every year to get at least the proposed funding that the Obama administration wanted for it. I actually wasn't bothered by the cut and the tight funding, because that keeps them sharp. I don't want them to get unlimited funds. But nonetheless, they had to convince Congress. And after 4 years, Congress no longer fights this. They now give money to commercial space. Unfortunately, they insist on giving more money to SLS and Orion and now LOPG. And that's because of the incompetence and the... They're not thinking of the nation here. They're really not. They're thinking of their election, and they're thinking of how can I funnel pork into my districts in the most efficient manner, whether or not it's efficient for doing anything in space. And that's the problem. So, yes, there are factions within NASA that are doing things, and there are factions within the federal government. I'll give you an example of where they did things right. A launch by SpaceX sometime in the spring, it was following the first Falcon Heavy launch. They had to cut off television broadcast because NOAA had added a bureaucracy in NOAA, an office in NOAA, told them that any photography of the Earth has to be regulated by this office, and you can't even show shots of a rocket stage separating if the Earth is in the background without getting their approval. And so SpaceX said, we can't broadcast the rest of this launch because we've been told by NOAA we have to get a license. Essentially, that agency was making the stupid claim that any photography of the Earth from space must be licensed by them, including, let's say, an astronaut on ISS with a camera. It was an absurd position. And to quote Wilbur Ross, the head of commerce in the Trump administration, this is stupid. It must stop. And in the reorganization of the regulatory bodies that do commercial space that's going on right now in the Trump administration, that agency, that office, disappeared. They basically absorbed it into commerce and basically told them, you don't exist anymore. You're now part of the bureaucracy in commerce that's going to regulate space. And we're trying to simplify the regulation, and you're gone. Now, did anyone get fired? I doubt it. It's the federal government.
They moved them over.
But they moved them over, but they moved them over in a position of no power. And so that is positive. They very clearly made it very clear to the NOAA agency, you're wrong and you're not doing this and it's over. It's not going to happen. And this is the kind of action that a government has to, that elected officials and have to do. And this is why we got Trump. I mean, his administration is willing to do those kind of things, not to stand by and say, well, we don't know, maybe they're right. No, they were completely absurd and wrong, and the administration told them so and shut it down. And so that's an example. And the reorganization that's going on right now, and Congress is part of this, and this is a positive thing, Congress is part of this, and the administration is part of it. They are trying, and they're asking the industry's opinions on this. And because the people with the most clout right now in the industry are the commercial space business, because that's really where the action is, they're paying attention to what these people want. And what they all want is a simplified regulatory system that will allow launches to go forward faster and easier, and payloads to be launched faster and easier. And that's what they're looking into right now, trying to make that happen. And I think it's a very positive step. It's moving in the right direction.
Absolutely. And I've had several entrepreneur CEOs on, and they have been giving feedback in this process, and they claim that they're being listened to.
Yeah, and that's my impression as well. The Trump administration, for all Trump's personal flaws, is focused on freeing up the American public to accomplish what it wants to do. And that involves things like space exploration and allowing commercial space to function. They appear willing to face that. You know, it's a very complicated battle in that federal government because it's very big and unwieldy and has lots of people who you can't fire very easily. There is a push, and it's a positive thing. And it's not just in the Trump administration. It's also within Congress. And it's not just within the Republican Party, which runs Congress right now, which is the majority. There are Democrats who have actually been participating in this as well to try to simplify the bureaucratic situation in the space industry. I mean, you had State Department involved. You had NOAA involved. You had NASA involved. And you had the FAA at Department of Interior. Yeah, I think it's Interior. FAA is in Interior. And Commerce is well involved. And there's just too many agencies. And they're trying to consolidate it all into Commerce with the FAA's Office of Space AST office, commercial space, still in FAA. There'd be a slight duplication, but it would be simplifying the whole process. You'd get State Department out of it completely. That would be a very positive sign. And there's efforts to do that, and that's a positive thing.
We're pretty near the top of the hour. I'm going to take us to break now. So, listeners, hopefully you'll hear the break music and that I have resolved our problem. If not, you'll hear dead air, but we will be back in about 3 minutes. If you're an archive listener and you can tell that we stripped in the cuts, it means I still don't have it resolved. So bear with me on that, but hopefully it will be working. We do take phone calls during the break, and we'd love to hear from you. 1-866-687-7223, and email remains drspace, drspace at thespaceshow.com. And we'll be back with your calls, emails, and more from Bob Zimmerman in about 3 minutes. So don't go anywhere, everyone.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show,
and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And good evening, everybody. Welcome to part two of our Tuesday Space Show program. We do want to talk about our second segment sponsors for a brief minute. Integrated Space Analytics has the Integrated Space Plan, which is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. See how technologies and destinations build upon one another. And you can explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail. Their website is thespaceplan.com. And you can buy your own copy, full size. It's very inspiring. You can frame it, hang it on the wall or a door. Check it out, thespaceplan, one word, .com. AIAA that we talked about a few minutes ago, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, is our sponsor with over 30,000 individual members. 88 countries are represented, 95 or so corporate members are represented, and they're busy shaping the future of aerospace every day because they work in the industry. They advance the state of aerospace science, engineering, technology, and our understanding and knowledge of the universe. They have five conferences or forums per year. Their networking is superb. So do visit AIAA.org and check out their conferences when you can, or as I said, they're called forums. And then Celestis is a sponsor, and Celestis is still the only proven Memorial spaceflight service going on in the world today. And not only can you send the ashes of a loved one to space, you can do their DNA if you don't cremate, for example, but you can join your DNA with your loved ones so that you can make the journey together. They have a robust launch schedule for 2018, and you should check out about it. Check it out at their website, which is Celestis.com. They do advanced planning and pre-arrangement of the launch portion of your remains, or as I said, the DNA sample, Earth orbit and suborbital, and they're going to the moon later in the year as well. So again, check them out at Celestis, CelestisTIS.com. And Bob Zimmerman is our guest, and we'd like to hear more from you. And so the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223, and the lines are available right now. And email, if you would like to email Bob, is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Bob Blue is getting active. They're announcing price lists for their suborbital flights. They've got a test flight tomorrow. They seem to be sort of coming out strong now, don't they?
Well, I should point out that the price lists, that it was a Reuters report based on two anonymous sources within the company. The company itself denied that they've set any prices. The story said they were setting a price of $200,000 a ticket,
right,
$200,000 to $300,000, but the company denied that, and it's to two anonymous sources. I don't take I've linked up and behind the black, but to be honest, the press's track record when it comes to anonymous sources like this tends to be bad, to understate it. And at the same time, those prices don't seem unreasonable. So yeah, it could be the case. The most interesting thing to me about New Shepard, like he said, is going to be a test flight, they say, tomorrow. The most interesting thing about New Shepard to me is that they started this project about, what, 6-7 years ago?
Uh-huh.
Something like that. And they are about to have operational flights, they say, by next year, meaning they'll be selling tickets next year. And they have, 2 years ago, they in less than less than 6 years, 5 years, they accomplished their first space flight. They actually accomplished and reused the spacecraft five times doing space flights, getting up to space, 700 kilometers, 70 miles. I like to contrast that with Virgin Galactic, which started 14 years ago, has yet to do a powered flight to space, and has not accomplished anything in a very, very long time. They've done some test flights recently with their new ship, Unity, but they have not yet done a powered flight up to space. And they are now faced with the fact that after all these years with a gigantic head start, Blue Origin would beat them to the punch. I have also pointed out on space on Behind the Black, I made this prediction 2 years ago when Launcher One and its operation was pulled and separated out of Virgin Galactic to make a separate company, Virgin Orbit. I predicted at that time that Virgin Orbit would be flying commercially before Virgin Galactic gets its first space flight. And right now, Virgin Orbit is saying they're going to do their first test flights this summer, and that's actually fitting a schedule they've been talking about now for about a year. And they will have commercial flights happening by next year. There might be a delay in that, but I have no doubt they're still going to beat out Virgin Galactic to that first flight. And it's kind of sad that Virgin Galactic has been such a failure in all this time, especially since they've built a dead-end spacecraft. If they could have gotten it flying and making money from the beginning, that would have been cool. But, you know, Blue Origin built a New Shepard using and creating technology that they're going to scale up as well as use in their full-scale orbital craft. So they built technology that they could use for orbital space. And Virgin Galactic Spaceship 2 and is basically a dead end. And they're not going anywhere with it. It's very sad. Blue Origin is definitely a company to be reckoned with. I mean, their advantage, and maybe it's not an advantage, it's very dangerous when you have unlimited funds. You're really better off having a little bit of tight funding, and you have to be a little creative. But because Jeff Bezos is so rich, he sells a tiny amount of his Amazon stock each year to raise $1 billion each year. And has now for the last 2 years. I don't know if he'll do it a third year in a row, but he raises $1 billion by selling a tiny amount of his stock, and he says he puts that money into Blue Origin. Well, they got a lot of capital to work with. And so they have built that facility in Florida, and they're building New Glenn, and they say it's going to fly. You know, their BE-4 engine that New Glenn is dependent upon, they have been very quiet about it. They had an issue, and they seem to have fixed the issue, though they've been very quiet about the issue and how they fixed it. But they haven't done a lot of tests, firings of that engine. But, you know, I have faith that this company is going to make it happen. They're building their engine first, which is the way you do it. And I see them arriving on the launch market in the next 2-3 years. And when they do that, SpaceX will have real competition, and everybody else will be screwed. They won't be able to compete with these companies.
Alan, by email in Tulsa, said, yeah, are there any other suborbital or contending human spaceflight companies other than Blue and Virgin, maybe even outside the United States, or are those two it?
China, there's a company in China who says it wants to do it. They haven't gotten very far, though they say they've done stuff. There's a company in Japan that was going to try to do such a thing. They had a launch failure about a month ago, serious launch failure at the launch pad. I'm not sure they were going to go with suborbital tourism, though, once again. There have been a few companies worldwide that have mouthed that they want to do this, but nobody has cut metal in any significant way except for these two companies. And right now, the business belongs to Blue Origin. I don't see I don't see Virgin Galactic. They're not even in the race at the moment.
What about the balloon company?
Well, now that's interesting. Worldview in Tucson, here where I live, they have shifted. They were pushing the idea of selling tourist flights, several hour-long balloon tourist flights, up above the stratosphere at record heights, 20, 30 miles. It wouldn't be space, but you'd see the curve of the Earth. And they were pushing this at a relatively comparably cheap price. But they shifted about a year ago, and they're no longer pushing that very hard. They haven't, you know, for public relations purposes, they haven't said, we've abandoned it. They just simply aren't pushing it. What they're instead pushing now is stratospheric balloon flights for reconnaissance surveillance. They're pushing this for the military, and they apparently are having some success in getting contracts for it.
So they weren't doing well for the tourists, I guess?
I suspect what happened is they realized there was bigger money to be made for doing the surveillance balloon work for the government, for the military, and they weren't just not getting enough. There wasn't enough sales work for the balloons. If they succeed, I would suspect if I was them, and you had solid, reliable contracts launching stratospheric balloons unmanned for long periods of time to do military work, you then have the resources to refine that technology, and then you could sell it to the public. And I think they would probably come back again with their tourism down the road. They might be able to do it at a lower price at that point, and then maybe we'll raise the customer base. You know.
What about tourism flights with SpaceX? Do you hear anything about that?
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing. About a year and a half, 2 years ago, Elon Musk was talking about how he had people who were willing to come to him and pay him money to do a moon. Falcon Heavy Dragon flight around the moon.
Right.
And he was hoping, when he first talked about this 2 years ago, he was hoping to actually be able to fly that mission in December of 2018 on the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 8 mission, which would be really cool. That has kind of died. And so I haven't heard much about it. Part of it comes back to Crew Dragon again and how NASA is squelching a lot of Musk's more ambitious dreams. One of the things that people don't, you know, up until a year and a half ago, he was building Dragon with the Super Draco thrusters, and the idea was that Dragon would be able to land vertically like the first stage engines do. And of any company in the world, SpaceX has demonstrated they know the technology and the software and how to land vertically. So there's no reason to believe that putting in powerful enough thrusters on Dragon, it could not have landed vertically on land using thrusters. And that was their plan. And they were going to install that, and that was going to be used on the manned Crew Dragon that was going to go to ISS. And it was also going to be used on the Red Dragon capsule that they wanted to use Falcon Heavy to launch to Mars. Well, NASA didn't like those Super Draco thrusters and a vertical landing. They wanted SpaceX to take the safe route and use parachutes. And so the pressure was on, and Elon Musk, it's his biggest customer. He decided discretion is the better part of valor. He backed off. He abandoned the Super. As far as I know, he's abandoned the Super Draco thrusters. They might be part of it, but he's gone to parachutes. And he's also abandoned, for the moment, sending a Dragon capsule to Mars at every rendezvous opportunity. As far as I know, none are planned. And the reason, of course, is if you don't have your Super Draco thrusters and you haven't tested it to vertically land, you can't land on Mars. And so NASA has basically squelched that at the moment. Now, in terms of SpaceX's tourism, once they get both Boeing with the Starliner and SpaceX with Dragon, once they get manned flights up, they own those capsules. There is nothing to prevent them from selling the product and seats on it to somebody else. Boeing has a deal with Bigelow that they will launch a Bigelow B330 space module, which is their biggest module, sometime around 2020, and Starliner will provide the fairing services to it using an Atlas rocket. Well, they have this deal, but until the Starliner actually flies, they can't really get it off the ground. That is a tourism opportunity, but Bigelow has said it's not just tourism. They want to offer this to other countries. You know, countries like the United Arab Emirates, for example, is very interested in this kind of stuff. In fact, if NASA hadn't slowed down Dragon and Starliner, and they had flown and been available now, the UAE wants to fly one of its citizens as an astronaut, and they don't have the rocket capabilities or the capsules, they have to buy the services, and they were looking to buy the service from someone. Well, they had only one place. They only had two places where they could go, either the Chinese or the Russians. And the Chinese, obviously, are not interested in selling tickets right now. The Russians, of course, are. And so they bought the ticket from the Russians. Well, if Boeing and SpaceX had been available, they would have sold those tickets to them. And it's very likely they would have made that sale. And the same thing with Bigelow. UAE wants to do things in space. Well, if Bigelow's got a station up there and a ferrying capabilities, UAE might rent space there to put their astronauts on it. And so there is possibilities here, not necessarily tourism, but it's definitely possibilities for profit. And the obstacle right now is the bureaucracy and the government, which sees private enterprise, independent private enterprise, as a threat to their turf, and that they're interfering with it.
It's amazing that there are members in Congress that do see that, but I'm assuming it comes from lobby pressure from the traditional partners.
There is a mixed thing in Congress, but there's no doubt. There is no doubt that the big money from companies like Boeing and Lockheed Martin has influences.
Oh, it influences policy.
Yeah, they are terrified of them. And I will tell you for personal experience, I know that those two big giants use their clout to try to squelch their opposition. The think tank that I was that published Capitalism in Space was put under enormous pressure by Boeing and Lockheed Martin to try to prevent Capitalism in Space from being published.
Okay, I have another email for you.
Okay,
listeners, come on, you can do phone calls. Nobody's at work tonight. 1-866-687-7223. Boy, I go the 11th mile to get the phone to ring, and I think I'm going to start doing shows without the toll-free line, and then maybe people start asking me why I don't make it available again.
I ask people on Behind the Black, my readers, to call in, please. You know,
well,
I'm not
they don't
bite
like
you.
To call. They email, but I think I'm going to do a couple of shows coming up, and I'm just going to say, since you guys don't care to use the toll-free line, it's not available tonight, but we'll take your email.
Yeah, the other way to do it, David, is just don't allow them to email or put comments up. They've got to call, you know. Maybe that's a more...
Well, I mean, they can... The only thing I can do there is if they send an email is just to ignore it.
Right.
I don't... If they posted a comment on the blog, I wouldn't necessarily read it, but I wouldn't take it off the blog. I would let them...
Call! I'd love
say.
To call.
Yeah, you I know you do like
I don't,
the calls.
But you
have another email, and this is from Jane. And Jane is says she's in the Chicago area.
She's emailed me in the past, I think.
Maybe. I hear from a lot of people in the Chicago area.
Yeah.
And Jane says, given that there is a lot of criticism on some of these policies, and I understand that the Howard Bloom Group has actually started a petition to shut down SLS Orion and Lot G on WhiteHouse.gov's petition list. Do you think that the opposition might become strong enough to alter SLS Orion and Lot G?
I think that the inability of those projects to accomplish anything.
Even the petition?
No, well, wait, let me finish my point. The petition is a sign, the existence of the petition is a sign of the continuing shift away from these big government programs. The recognition more and more within the industry, willingness within the industry to speak up against them, it's a sign of that. And I think that in the next 5 years, the continuing success of private space and the continuing in lack of success within those big projects will make itself evident to Congress, and they'll finally begin to realize, and it's already beginning to happen, that there are more votes to be gained by switching to commercial space and not supporting the pork. And once again, this brings us back, I have to say this, back to Trump, because there are now politicians. Trump, once again, is here because of the dysfunctional nature of the federal government and the desire of the public to get that fixed. Well, there are now a lot of politicians who are realizing they can win votes by doing that instead of distributing pork. And so it seems counterintuitive for the last century. Oh, you got it. If you don't sell pork in your district, you're not going to win votes. Well, that doesn't appear to be the case so much anymore. And so I think that in the next 5 years, you're going to continue to see a shift away from these big projects. The petition is an example of how that shift is happening. You wouldn't have... When I saw, was at that AIAA conference about 2 years ago, they were lobbying privately with Congress to try to shift the situation, but they were also very careful not to say things that might offend the powers that be and the big projects. That's beginning to change. People are willing to say, kill it. That's what the petition says.
Willing to be offensive now.
Yeah. This has got to die. It's preventing us from accomplishing anything, and it's going to actually act to prevent us from accomplishing anything, and we've got to get rid of it. And that's a change. And so I see the movement is happening. So, Jane, that's my impression of how things go. The more people that pay attention to this and say things, the more likely things will shift. Once again, my approach here is not to eliminate a space as a government operation. Space is a national prestige issue. It's a national security issue. We have to have a vibrant space industry for the United States to prosper. But there's many ways to do that, and the way we've been doing it for the last 50 years, I think, has not been productive. And it also results in a bloated federal government in NASA, and we need to clean that up and have a much more efficient way of doing things.
Okay, so you have another phone call, and now I'm implementing my new psychic powers and welcoming Charles Lurio to the show. Hi, Charles. Welcome to the show.
I'm very impressed.
I got it right.
You must have caller ID, David.
No, I took a psychic course over the internet for $10.99, and Charles was this call was my first try at.
Okay.
Well,
David, you've got psychic powers, can you tell us what's going to happen in the space industry in the coming decades?
I am, but I have not finished making my stock market investments yet.
Oh,
so I'm not willing to open my mouth yet until I'm all securely invested and ready to make my sales when you guys bid my prices up for me.
Hi, Charles.
Hi. Bob, when you were talking about the Dragon version 2 and the Super Draco and the Draco, the Crew Dragon does use the Super Dracos. It has to, because that's its launch escape system. So those are remain. You said earlier that you thought that they had dispensed with that.
I wasn't sure if they were out of the capsule. I do know that they have apparently dispensed with using them for a vertical landing in a launcher.
That's true. But actually, that's been for some time now. They were given the old
marching orders.
Yeah, so to speak. I was going to say something more graphic, but you know. Anyway, couldn't quite come up with a metaphor. They are the Super Dracos. The difference is, of course, that if you just use them for a launch escape, then you don't have to use the deep throttling capability, because obviously they have to be, you know, go snap right on, you know, full thrust. High thrust.
Yeah, like
are you saying that the design of the Super Dracos could be simplified by using them just for launch abort escape?
I'm saying that I don't know whether they have simplified them, but that's possible. But I know that they had tested throttling on a Super Dracos before they changed the baseline on the return. Whether they have actually changed the engine design to be only operable essentially as the escape thing, or whether it's still, you know, something that could be throttled. I don't know.
My guess would be they have changed it to make it simple, and that's why they have abandoned Red Dragon to Mars, because they don't have a throttable Super Dracos to use for landing.
And they did
that under. I don't know this for a fact, but just I know how NASA works and how this. They were probably ordered by NASA to simplify it. Also.
Oh yeah, no, I have. I totally agree with you about that. But it's most likely that that was the situation.
Mm-hmm.
All I'm just saying is that they did do tests with the Super Dracos doing the deep throttling. So as long as they can maintain the historical memory of that kind of version of it. Then it still theoretically could be reinstituted.
I would expect once SpaceX gets over the hump and actually starts to fly astronauts for NASA, they're going to do what they did with Falcon, and they're going to take advantage of any opportunity they've got to test a vertical landing of Dragon. They're going to look for a way in which they can do that. They might eventually shift their cargo flights to use the Dragons with Super Dracos, and then they can test it on a return.
Well,
but I expect them to try this once they got over the hump and they're flying.
I believe that their intention has been to switch to the Dragon version 2 for everything. They're flying. They're not making any more of the version 1s.
No, we're both on the same page. They're right now using the older Dragons as cargo and reusing them, and they're not building any more. And eventually they're going to shift entirely to Dragon 2, Crew Dragon for everything. And I would expect that as soon as they've got manned flights operational and they're flying and they're in the driver's seat at that point and NASA can't boss them around anymore, they're going to start doing operational tests again.
One can hope.
This is their operational procedure, and I give Elon Musk politically, he's a lot of credit. He knows how to play this game. As soon as he's in a position, this is one of the reasons I think the Dragon capsule was delivered this week to Florida. He is going to demonstrate undeniably that he's ready to launch. He's going to make it clear that the only reason he's not launching is without being offensive or doing anything that could cause him trouble in the politics, he's making it very clear we're ready.
Well, they're supposed to be doing a in-flight abort test in sometime in the next few months, as well as the uncrewed launch to the station.
Right.
So we'll see about your theory that the latter will get delayed further.
Hey, well, and let me ask you something, Charles. You might know why, and I've puzzled over this. Almost 4 years ago, SpaceX looked like it was very close to doing an actual launch abort from launch. They did a ground launch abort test, and they actually had announced they were going to do within just a few months they actually gave a date, I don't remember what it was, of doing an actual launch abort test where they'd launch the rocket and then release the capsule and it would come back. And that disappeared from the schedule. Do you know why?
No, I don't. Although it could be related to your point about them switching from powered landing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but
the other day I was, I really don't have any special insight into that question.
I mean, it puzzles me because if they switch to parachute landings in a launch abort, well, they've got that technology with the Dragon cargos. So all they've got to do is do a launch, release the capsule from the launch vehicle with the Dracos, and then the parachutes come out. And in fact, they said that they now do this routinely on every launch because of the launch failure a few years ago where the Dragon capsule was released, and if the parachutes had been there capable of releasing, they could have saved the capsule. And so they've said they're doing that on every launch. So I would think they could do a launch abort relatively.
Well, they've been doing, I don't know if you noted this, but there was a thing a few weeks ago where they showed a sequence of a Dragon version 2 under parachutes. They've had drop tests,
right,
of the thing under parachutes, more than 10 of them, or
yeah,
something,
I know.
Really high number that I wouldn't necessarily expect.
That could relate to what NASA's safety panels have demanded of Boeing. They demanded Boeing do an unordered amount of parachute drop tests that made no sense to me, since this is technology that's well known. And it comes back to my theory that they're slowing these projects down.
Oh, I wouldn't be at all surprised to see direct evidence of that. But as far as I'm concerned, it's the natural tendencies of the bureaucracy that is doing this, my only disagreement with you might be a little bit less of the, well, they're, you know, this is part of an evil plan, cunning plan.
Yeah, there's nightly whiplash with curling his mustache in the background.
Charles,
the commercial.
Have you signed the petition to end SLS and Orion and LOP G?
Oh, I don't know. What the hell good does a petition do, in my opinion? Because, I mean, unless what they need, petition isn't dollars.
Yeah.
It isn't the stuff that you know, a whole bunch of space enthusiasts getting together and sending a few thousand signatures is not going to change a damn thing, in my opinion.
There is an aspect of this, though, that is important to understand, though. For politicians, votes and public opinion is currency they depend on. If the petition got a lot, and this is where I agree with you, actually, but if it got a lot of signatures from a wide range of people, some noted, that might carry influence with the Trump administration's policy.
Well, that,
and with Congress.
It might carry more influence with the Trump administration than with the Congress. But
yeah.
Speaking of the Trump administration, which one can not predict the trajectory on any one day, that was my. I'm always leery of what the administration's situation will. It may be that space is so unimportant in people's minds that it won't be affected by the larger issues that the Trump administration creates for itself, but we'll have to see about that. Meanwhile, by the way, I was speaking of another topic. I thought that was an interesting exchange of tweets that Elon had about the thing in Thailand.
That was an example of Elon Musk should have kept his mouth shut.
All right, guys, I'm not going to take us there. So
yeah, all right.
We're going to stay on space.
All
Carl.
Right. Well, just so you know, I'm a caver, so I could actually speak from knowledge of caving.
Yeah, and I'm a diver, and I dove in caves, and all. I could too, but we're not going to go there.
Oh, you've done cave diving, David?
Yeah, a lot of it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well,
Actually, cool.
I'm pretty sympathetic to him, but on this.
Okay, well, let it go. Also,
I don't. Maybe I just don't know enough to know.
Yeah, you don't.
So, anyway.
Yeah.
Whatever you say.
I agree with David.
Stay with space, Charles. And if you sign the petition, let me know.
All right.
Okay, and that goes for you too, Bob. If you signed the petition. You did sign the petition.
I did. I decided
now I have to.
I mean, you know,
under your real name,
it has limited influence. I realize that, but I feel that you know they're basically repeating the position I've had for the last 5 years since Constellation got canceled, and it's essentially the position I took in Capitalism in Space. So if somebody else is going to espouse positions that I've been pushing for the last 5 years, I'm going to support them on that.
So you signed it under your real name?
Of course.
Okay. Have you been audited yet by the IRS?
I hope.
Well, the FBI is coming.
Boy, the amount of publicity that would, you know.
Everybody, Bob Zimmerman signed the petition. You want his address and phone number, I'll give it to you. Anything else, Dr. Lurio?
Not at this time. I'm sitting, sweating in the car, waiting to pull it into the garage because I have no phone reception
Such commitment and loyalty to space and the space show. Charles, I commend you.
Isn't it unbelievable?
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. That's why everybody's life works.
Incredible. That's why everybody loves me.
Absolutely, Charles. Absolutely. Thank you for calling.
They throw money at me like, with great abandon.
Everybody, the Lurio Report
I'm daydreaming now.
Yeah, and check him out at the Lurio Report, LURIO Report.com. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you, David.
All right.
Thank you, Charles.
Bob. Listeners, Charles has left the stage, so it is 1-866-687-7223. We can still take another call or two if you have something to say. Also, you can we can take your emails as well, and I do have a couple more emails for you.
Oh, good.
This is Robert, and Robert is in New Orleans, and he says, "Is there any service that tells us the space position of a particular candidate running for office?" Usually their websites don't do it unless they're in an active space state like Florida. But even in California, I've looked, and there's nothing about space on the Senate races or anything else. Isn't there some kind of space service that will direct it as to who thinks what about space?
No, and you couldn't trust it even if you did. It's very difficult. They're politicians. Do you really think you can trust what they tell you today, tomorrow? You can't. They're politicians. I mean, Alexis de Tocqueville, when he visited the United States in 1830s, said, Americans have an incredible disdain for their politicians, even though they love their democracy. Nothing's changed, and for good reason. It's very difficult. What I look at the position that I take. I want private enterprise and freedom to function. I do not want it to be a centralized government-run program. I hate that word, program. It should be a free, chaotic enterprise of many people following their dreams. Well, that's a fundamental political choice that is very clear in the political realm today. You don't have to know their specific space positions to know which candidate is more likely to follow what I've just espoused. Now, you can disagree with me, then you know who to vote for as well. But that's where I generally go now, because you got to at least look for the people who believe in freedom and preemption.
So if they support commercialization and lower regulation and free enterprise, right, you would make the assumption they probably support that for space too.
Yeah, and I would also recognize that being politicians, that it's not a reliable expectation. I mean, I'll use Ted Cruz as an example, who had all the appearances of a really strong conservative who wanted to, quote his words during the election campaign, clean up the Washington cartel. That was his term for Trump's term, draining the swamp. Well, since the election, he's kind of become somewhat wishy-washy about draining the cartel in D.C. And so you can't trust any of these guys. I mean, would I choose him over someone else? Yeah, I probably would. But the point is that you have to recognize they're politicians. You never fall in love with them. You always be prepared to throw them out. no loyalty to these guys. They have no loyalty to you, and people have to recognize that. That's one of the problems my generation has had. There's too many people in my generation who fall in love with politicians who think they're their heroes, and these people are not their heroes.
Hardly.
And you've got to recognize that. You vote for who you think will do the best job. You watch them closely, and then you kick them out of office first chance you get if you don't like what they're doing. And you make them aware that you're the boss. And Americans haven't been doing that. We keep reelecting incumbents 90%, and that's how you get abuse by the federal government. And you get an incompetent federal government that is incapable of accomplishing anything.
You got another caller.
Okay.
Okay. Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Gene in Pasadena.
Hi, Gene.
Hey, Gene.
Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, thanks. Great show, Bob.
Thank you.
And David, I always enjoy your conversations with David and some of the other shows that you pop up on from time to time.
By the way, are you headed to the Mars Society gig in Pasadena in August?
I'm not driving over at the moment, but...
No, I mean, it's going to be in Pasadena, if that's where you're calling from.
I know. I do quite a bit of last-minute traveling, and it's a little hard for me to say, yeah, I'm going to be a certain
place.
Well,
I'm coming down for that event, so maybe some Space Show listeners, we can find a way to say hello to one another at the conference or around the
area. Yeah, if I'm available, if I'm not out of town, yeah, I'd like to swing by there. I've heard their stories, though, for years and years. I'm sure you have, too.
Absolutely. So, okay, so go ahead with Bob on why you called.
A couple of things. One is when you were talking about the, the Boeings and the Lockheed Martins and the maybe even Northrops, but especially Boeing and Lockheed, not, you know, being interested in commercial space too much now because they like the government contracts. And then you were talking about how the space, commercial space activities could have really been launched back in the 1960s, and that some of the big companies, AT&T and some of the others, were quite interested in that, and that the rocket companies like McDonnell Douglas back then could have gotten into it, not quite the way Musk is, but close to it. My thinking on that is that back in the 60s, I think corporations, aerospace corporations, and most of the rest of them, we're not quite as averse of looking at the long view. I don't think their investors were pushing them to, have quarterly profits and all of that. So they would have had more flexibility. I know that McDonnell Douglas was very active on the shuttles before the Challenger accident when they were trying to do some of these, electrochoresis experiments with one of the Johnson & Johnson divisions. They were aggressively going after it. And apparently, they had right up until the crash or the explosion, they had some very aggressive plans to continue expanding their facilities on board the shuttle in 1987. They were going to go into full-scale production of some of these things. But today, you can't get that from the aerospace companies because the executives are pretty much tied to the whims of the investors, and the investors are very short-term.
I think there's truth to what you're saying without Gene. I think there is truth to that. It's a cultural change. I could use as an example John Kennedy's speech at Rice University back in the early 60s where he gave some of his, we do this because it's hard, not because it's easy speech, where he talked about why we're going to the moon. And I've listened to that speech. It's worth listening to because it shows you the level of intellectual rigor that was required of a speech. It's not a lot of short-term sound bites. It's an actually thought-out, detailed explanation of why he wants to do this, and it's very clear that he and the nation was deciding to go to space, not necessarily for themselves, but for long-term future generations' benefits, that not their generation, but the next generation. It's going to cost us money, but in the future, our children will benefit from it. There was awareness of that. People had a longer view. I agree with you, but I also say that, you can't generalize. Even within Boeing, it's a schizophrenic company. You've got the big culture that's building SLS and is involved in LOPG, but then you've also got the subdivisions that are building Starliner and X-37B, and those groups are have a very different mindset. And so they're within the company. There's even a little bit of the civil war going on. It's a big company, and they're fighting this. You also have a situation with SpaceX. He's forcing the corporate companies to think longer term because he doesn't have to deal with the corporate, you know, stockholders. He owns it. You know, it's a privately held company, so it's what Elon Musk wants to do, and he's taking risks, and he's doing things. And it's the same thing with Jeff Bezos. They're free to do what they want, and they're willing to take risks. And that's forcing companies like Ariane Group and ULA, I'm sure Tory Bruno will confirm this when he's on your show, David, they're forcing them to rethink. And in fact, the ULA board fired the guy that was in charge before Tory Bruno because he was not willing to take the risks to reshape the company to properly compete with SpaceX. He just wasn't. He thought a public relations campaign would do the job, and it was not going to do the job. And so they brought Tory Bruno in to reshape the company and make it competitive. And I think he's done a remarkably good job considering the corporate culture he's got to work in. And so your question's a good one, but I think that the advantage we have now is that there are companies that are privately held that are free to do what they want, and that forces everybody else to compete.
Yeah, and in a peculiar way, you could say that this new aggressive new space effort really goes back to the internet, because if the internet hadn't been set up by DARPA, there wouldn't be any billionaires like Musk and like Bezos and the rest of them. they wouldn't have had the freedom to do what they're doing. There weren't that many, you know, billionaires around in the 80s and maybe even the 90s. And if they were more real estate or, you know, things that weren't as innovative as the internet has allowed it to happen. So,
Gene, if you go to Behind the Black and you do a search, actually at the top of the page, there's a menu across the top, and that menu has on it a bunch of things, one of which is Space Watch, important Space Watch columns. And you click on that. Actually, the last column, History's Moment of Truth, is the column I'm talking about. It's listed right there. I talk about how there has been, culturally, a renaissance was coming about at the turn of this century, beginning of the 21st century, that wasn't obvious in most of my life with my generation. And that's an important distinction that have to be recognized. It's not just that the internet allowed billionaires to occur. It's that in the 90s, a new generation came along that was very mentally different than my 60s generation. They had a much more open-minded, innovative, risk-taking point of view when it came to engineering and business. So it wasn't just internet that made them appear. It was this change in culture. And it's very clearly a change in culture that I think the internet helped fuel, but I think that maybe the culture helped fuel the internet. It was a chicken egg both ways. And I think that even if they had not made the internet this newer generation, even if DARPA hadn't made the internet, this new generation would have forced it upon us because they were being creative. And
it's true. I'm not sure they could have done it quite as quickly as, you know, with the way it actually happened with DARPA triggering it, and then these younger people in the 90s that have the attitude that you're describing. They looked at that and they recognized this is much, much more than what DARPA had in mind.
Right.
And
right.
They took it and they really, you know, started flying with it.
Right, exactly. Now, if the internet had not existed as it was, you know, forget about DARPA's internet, but there were bulletin boards and other things beginning to appear related to computer geeks.
Right.
It would have appeared. It would have happened. They would have found a way because the money to be made was so great and these people wanted to innovate and do stuff. And so I think it would have happened anyway, and we would have gotten the billionaires we've got today, or maybe there have been different ones, but we'd have gotten it, and it would still be in the same boat. I think the bottom line is that buried within American culture, despite almost a century of trying to emulate the Soviet Union culturally, buried within our culture is a deep, deep, deep belief in the concepts of freedom and competition. And it comes out no matter what you want to do. And this is our blessing, and it's going to keep the country alive, I think. And I think this is an example of that, and I hope that's
down the road. I think you're absolutely right. I've talked to a lot of these younger aerospace engineers that you referred to a short time ago.
Yeah.
The ones that were, that you found at the AIAA conference, you know, that were so frustrated by the government programs. Well, I've talked to those younger people. I used to work for a company that had a big aerospace division in the 90s, and they had some layoffs. So they moved them over to the, you know, to the automotive group where I was working. And we, I got a chance to talk to dozens and dozens of those guys that used to work on it. It was TRW at the time before they broke it up. Worked on some of the space projects at TRW, and they were constantly telling me how frustrated they were that they weren't given a freer rein to go ahead and expand on some of the ideas they had. They said everything was so constrained by the government programs.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing I was going to ask you about, though, is the, you know, these lava tubes on the moon. You being a caver, do you have any thoughts about that? About
yes, I've written about this. I actually had an article in Sky and Tell a few years ago called Caves in Space. And if you do a search, once again, on Behind the Black for caves, you'll see a whole bunch of articles. I actually did some of my own original research with a working with an engineer, NASA engineer James Fincannon. We both did some took some close looks at images that Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter was sending down of places like the floor of Copernicus, and looking to see what's there, and came up with some potential cave locations that maybe are accessible. You know, and then the question is, would these work? And so take a look at Behind the Black. I've definitely looked at this at great length. There are enormous advantages to being underground on alien planets like Mars and the Moon. You eliminate the temperature shifts. You have a much more controlled environment. You protect yourself very quickly from radiation. It's much easier to create a sealed environment in many ways. The biggest problem is access in and out, and exploring it initially, because your access in and out is not so simple. But once you beat that problem, and that's an easily beatable problem, you've got a place to establish a colony that's relatively easy to do. And there have been studies on the moon, for example, where because of the low gravity, the lava tubes are going to be much larger. The structural needs to keep the roof up are much less, and so you can have a much larger space on the ground. And there have been lava tubes found that are much larger than that. The Indians, Chandrayaan orbiter found a few that were thought, oh, these are much larger. The underground space is much bigger. The roof couldn't hold up on Earth, but on Mars and the Moon it can. And the same thing on Mars. Mars is even more interesting because the caves that have been located on Mars, many of them are located in places where they think there's underground water, and the two combined is priceless. I have written about this on Behind the Black. Arcia Mons, which is the southernmost of the three big volcanoes to the east of Olympus Mons, they have found evidence of glacial activity on its western slopes. Routinely, seasonally, there are clouds forming above it. So this suggests underground water, and there have been pits and caves located in that region. When you put all those factors together, it's also somewhat near the equator, and you have a potential place to build a colony.
Guys, I got to move us on. I've got two more emails, and we're coming up on 2 hours.
Gene, thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you both.
Thank you, Gene. Call again. Two emails. I'll do the quickest one first. Is from Paul Turner. And it's really a statement that I'm going to read more than a question for you. I'm glad you're on the show, and I will look up your book, Capitalism in Space. It's actually a paper, not a book.
It is a free download on Behind the Black. Just go to the menu at the top under Books, and you'll see Capitalism in Space, and you can download the PDF.
Right. Because I sense quite strongly that it is brother to my own views of the future and how to get there. As expressed on the Space Show back in February 2015, I truly believe that we talk a lot about engineering feats by space companies, but what is lacking is the marriage of engineering and the investment community. So in the Space Trade Update, there is a completely revised investor guide that uses a tried and true system used by the American real estate development industry. Thanks for inviting such forward-looking guests. Boy, that's a rare one. And this is Paul Turner, and he's a JP Aerospace associate up in the Sacramento region.
Okay. I mean, I have no comment. I agree.
Okay, now, in the remaining time, I guess you can do Todd's question. So Todd is in San Francisco. Todd is in San Diego, and he says, it wouldn't be right, Bob, for you to come on the space show and to not tell us your views on creating a separate military force known as the U.S. Space Force. He wants to know your views.
I've commented on this at length for John Batchelor on my appearances with John. I think that at this moment in time, it is absurdly premature for the Trump administration to proposing something like this. It's premature. It's stupid. We'll have a bunch. It's another bureaucracy that that people in the administration want to create, and congressmen want to create, and it's a totally useless thing. You can have guys in space cadet uniforms. What are they going to do? Without question, once again, streamlining the bureaucracy within the Pentagon for running space operations is a good idea. And if that's the goal, then I'm totally in favor of it. But that's not how they're couching it in the public statements, including Trump. They're couching it as a military operation to defend American interests in space. And even though, yes, I think that's someday going to be necessary, especially because the Outer Space Treaty is going to be in power force and preventing us from establishing sovereignty, we're going to need military force to protect ourselves. This is not the time. The focus should be, once again, in streamlining the bureaucracies in government, both military and civilian, to encourage the proper development of space. I will point out that the Air Force, which has been running space for decades now, in the last 3 years, since Elon Musk's court suit forced them to allow him to bid on their contracts, since then, it's like a light bulb went off, and they have been moving aggressively to change their whole culture and approach to private space. They're encouraging competition. They're pushing for smaller and more frequent launches, no longer giant gold-plated projects that take years to launch, and if they fail, you're screwed. They want to have multiple smaller satellites. They want to have cheaper launches. They want to have competition. They want to open up the certification process as much as possible. It's one of the reasons they approved the Falcon Heavy so quickly and have awarded a contract before their first test launch. You know, it flew once. They have a test launch scheduled for later this year. It's not launched yet. It's an experimental launch just to prove that SpaceX can work with them and launch a satellite. But they have already awarded the Falcon Heavy a contract for the Air Force. So the Air Force has really been doing a good job in trying to change their culture to be more efficient and streamlined. And for that, then that aspect, a Space Force, quote, might make sense. But if you're thinking in terms of a military operation, it is beyond stupid.
Any closing comments? Anything else you'd like to say? We're on a two-hour show tonight.
Well, we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of Genesis of Apollo 8, and, you know, I've got the book, Genesis, Story of Apollo 8, out. You know, I also have written a science fiction book that people might want to read. This is a book I wrote actually in the 80s called Pioneer. And I think I'd really like to hear people's response to it. I read it for the first time in decades about a year ago and discovered it was pretty good. I had not read it in years and forgotten it. And it just,
we've talked about it on a previous space show program.
Yeah, we did talk about it a little bit, and I was shocked how good it was. I mean, you know, I didn't remember what I had written. And so I decided I'm going to publish it. It's an e-book.
How did they get it?
I can just put it out. So I did, and it's been selling actually pretty good and getting great reviews. And, you know, it's a really good read. And the interesting thing about it is, even though I wrote it in the 80s, it's not dated.
How did they get it? It's on Amazon?
It's on Amazon. It's on all the ebook vendors. You can go to Behind in the Black, and there's a link there to buy it. I get a little bit of bigger cut if you buy it through my website, but if you buy it from Amazon, that's fine too. It's, what, $4? It's not an expensive purchase. There is something I state in the introduction. I'm going to say it here. You can find out the answer if you dig around in Behind the Black, but there is one word that is not in the book that every modern science fiction book about space exploration always includes, and I don't include it. And I like to see if people can guess what that word is. I do reveal the answer on Behind the Black, but you got to dig around to find it. But there is one word that's not in the book that every science fiction book...
So anyone who guesses it, do they win anything? Is there a benefit for them?
They get the honor of being smart.
They don't, like, get a... 5-minute interview on Behind the Black or something like that?
Hey, if they guess it, I'll send them an email. I mean, I know I don't have any rewards, but it is an interesting intellectual puzzle that I like people to play with, because what word is in every modern science fiction book about space exploration that I don't include? What is that word?
Is it a clean word or a filthy word?
Oh, it's totally clean. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes, yes, yes. It's absolutely clean. But you got to read my book to get an idea. If you read Pioneer, it's a first contact story. I'll give the basic premise, John, David, very quickly. You got this crusty old miner comes back from a mission to bring an asteroid to Mars. He lands on the colony. As he's flying back, he sees a glint on the slopes of Olympus Mons that shouldn't be there. They land, and what they discover is the half-buried body of an astronaut who disappeared 46 years earlier on an asteroid beyond Jupiter. An asteroid that when they went to try to rescue him was no longer what it was supposed to be. How did he get to Mars? More important, among his effects, among the body, is a 6-fingered robot arm, clearly alien-made. So the story then goes, how did this happen? Where did he come from? How did he get back? Who's the aliens? And so the main character, Saunders Maxwell, decides he's going to find out. And it's a good story. It's really a rip-roaring, old-fashioned space opera story that's really a lot of fun to read. And I was surprised. Once again, I thought it would be when I reread it last summer for the first time in 20 years, I really thought it would be like reading a first novel, which usually I've read a lot of first novels and screenplays, and usually they want to make you puke. And I expected my first novel to be that way, and I was honestly and sincerely surprised how good a read it was. And it isn't dated. That's the most important thing. I have a few minor anachronisms that in the 80s, were clearly not, that we now know couldn't just ridiculous, but generally no, it's not dated, and so it's a very good read.
Okay,
you know, so that's my, you know, but space is a place.
All right, Bob, until the next time, I appreciate it. I hope you feel better and get rid of your cold.
Oh, me too, Dick.
And keep looking up, as we say.
Yeah.
But stand far away from the exhaust. We'll talk to you soon, my friend.
All right.
Okay, listeners, that's it. Thank you very much for your participation in tonight's show. So Friday we talk about a space commodities market. You can read about that on our newsletter. And then we have our Sunday show. And space as usual on the space show. So, Sunday, Ebola Terra with Rand Simberg and Bill Simon. I almost forgot to start promoting that. And Friday, July 20th, is a very special day. And Bruce Pittman and Bruce Kahan from Stanford are talking about developing a space commodities market on July 20th. So everybody have a great rest of the week. Goodbye from Bob Zimmerman and David and the Space Show. And as I said, keep looking up.